So the, and there are many, many other ways. Time is not a simple thing. And we can reconceptualize it in different ways. And when we do so, and you know, it's kind of a simple act of magic, if you think about time differently, you think about your entire life differently, and you live your entire life differently, you know, you've changed your life. You've changed the world by reshaping your consciousness in a way that changes your relation, the relationship to the whole system in which you're a part. So, magic.
Mm-hmm. It seems to come, a lot of it comes down to language, I think. I mean, when I try and study from the inside, I mean, I am the thing that's studying the thing that's being studied, so it's very difficult. But the narrated self that both creates and is spawned by the idea of linear time seems to be tied in with the whole inception of language and creating these structures that spell out existence literally. And that's magic again, isn't it? It's spell casting.
Well, I mean, there's a reason why the word spell means both, you know, write out a word letter by letter and cast an enchantment.
Yeah. So, and that's, I mean, that's, I'm not saying this is going to be true for everyone, but for me, my the core experience I had on the occult path was that I learned that the occult path was a dead end. And that the only thing that works, to quote that guru who's really quite dodgy, but he did say one or two good things, the only thing that really works is surrender. And everything that I was doing to amass knowledge and power and status and all the rest of it, were, I couldn't separate them from the different disciplines that I was getting into. And so... Yeah, it. I mean, I still have the interest. It's just that it's the quality of it has subtly changed now.
Oh yeah, and the thing is, it's not for everybody. It really isn't. It's like, you know, not everybody's cut out to be a musician. Not everyone is cut out to be a priest or a priestess. Not everyone is cut out to be a scientist. Different people fill different roles in the whole system of humanity, and. Yeah, if you have a really hard time keeping what you're doing separate from that kind of craving for power, for status, this kind of stuff, that's going to be a real problem in occultism.
Yeah.
Because, and of course, it's a problem that a lot of people fall into, no question. But it's, you know, that's the thing. It's not for everybody.
Yeah, and you don't necessarily want to judge the technology by how you yourself have used it, I guess. Do you have any thoughts about liminality, seeing as that's the ostensible subject of this podcast, about liminality?
Liminality. I always saw myself floundering over that one because I have a hard time thinking of anything that doesn't partake of a liminal process in one way or the other.
Right.
I mean, you know, we could talk about the liminality of consciousness. We could talk about the liminality of the self, the relation between the self and the environment, and the boundaries and borderline between those. We can talk about the liminality of the human economy as the interface between the natural world and the world of you know, goods and services. Really, everything. I mean, unless you have some particular twist on liminality that you want to bring in here. Everything takes place in an interaction between more than one thing, along a liminal process where you can't really tell them apart.
So does that mean that, I mean, in that view, the liminality is just a natural state of existence, to be liminal?
It is the nature of existence.
Right.
If you just have one thing, I mean, we could get into occult philosophy here. If you just have one thing, you don't actually have anything.
Right.
You don't actually get... to borrow a druid, there's a bit of old druid mythology here. The universe came into being out of three rays of light, okay? Because you need the two opposites, and you need the liminal state between them before anything can come into being.
Right.
And so everything that comes into being is a liminal state between a pair of opposing forces.
So, but I mean, again, we're somewhat entrenched in the perception of time and the experience of linear time, so then there would be periods that are more liminal. I mean, there would be, if there's a liminal state, there also has to be a preliminal and a post-liminal state, right?
Yeah, and so I mean, time. You can see the liminality of time in complex ways. First of all, of course, the actual point where past becomes future,
yeah.
This liminal space of the present is very complex. It's much more complex than say physics tends to deal with. There are points, especially in the working of human consciousness, where before and after are extremely hard to tell apart. And, you know, a thing could be caused by something that happens after it. That's been shown experimentally, interestingly enough.
Yeah.
So you've got that. But then you also have the liminal relationship between time as flow and time as stasis, between, you know, the sort of whole landscape along which time moves and the flow of time. And the fact that consciousness, again, can occasionally, it works on the boundary between those. It really, there's moving time, and there's what we can call the timeless. And our own experience of the world is actually in that liminal zone between them.
Between time and timelessness.
Between time and the timeless, yeah.
Uh-huh.
And we can get really bent out of shape and fixate on flowing time and, you know, oh, you know, whoa. Or we can drift into a more timeless state and just experience the movement of time as a single thing from beginning to end, which we can see at least some part of at a glance. I mean, a lot of people do that in mystical experiences. Our skeptics will say, well, that doesn't count as a hallucination. Well, you know, hallucination means something people experience that you don't like. Gotcha.
All right. So... But the society that you're writing about, it would seem, or let's say specifically the society that you're on the margins of now, the US society, same here in Canada, I'm also on the margins of it. I don't necessarily experience it that directly, or I do go to a local grocery store and what have you. I'm not completely marginalized, but I don't really participate in it in terms of my values or my conversations or anything. I have conversations with people like yourself. But anyway, so far as I'm aware of it, it seems that that society is hell-bent, or individuals within it and collectively, on avoiding a liminal state, on certainty, on solidity, on stability.
Uh-huh.
Right?
And that's I think that's part of the mythos of progress, the mythos of the machine, the idea that everything should be clear and precise and mechanical and absolutely defined and dead. we're terrified, as a culture, we're terrified of the liminal. We're terrified of the undefined. We're terrified of the inside of our own heads, and which is another profoundly liminal space. And so, yeah, you get this fixation on trying to pretend that everything is just as mechanical as clanking gears, that there are no liminal states, there is no uncertainty, there is no blending between one thing and another, and it's a delusion. It's a very popular delusion just now, but it's a delusion. And the further people go into it, the more their perceptions and their choices lose contact with the world we actually live in, and the more destructive those choices turn out to be. I mean, to a great extent, you look at the things that industrial civilization is doing right now that is leading it face first into a brick wall of planetary limits. All of it has to do with a refusal to accept the idea that things blend into each other, that things respond, that things flow, that it's, you know, the world is not just this clanking machine set up to fulfill our desires.
Right.
So, you know, we treat the atmosphere like an aerial sewer. We dump gigatons of carbon into it. That's not supposed to do anything. Because the fact that it could circle around and bite us in the backside, there we're getting into liminality. There we're getting into, where is the boundary between human society and nature? We want a nice, strict boundary there. We don't want a liminal zone. But in fact, human society is simply a bit of flotsam floating on the ocean of nature.
Mm-hmm.
And so because there is that liminality, because we're not separate from nature, we depend on nature, we're looking at a situation. There was a recent report from scientists that they're pretty sure now that we could see anything up to 20 feet of sea level rise just from the carbon that's already out there. And, oh, by the way, not over a couple of centuries. It could happen in a couple of decades due to some mechanisms they didn't know about how ice sheet breakdown can feed on itself. Again, liminal things. There isn't a hard boundary between this ice sheet and that ice sheet, between this glacier and the sea. And it's in that boundary zone. This thing can spin out of control, send, you know, ice sheets splashing out into the ocean, and, you know, choose your coastal city, and it's got the sea 20 feet higher than it did 20 years ago. But it's all because of this unwillingness to see connectedness, this unwillingness to see flows that unite, the pattern that connects, as Gregory Bateson used to say. He was always said, I want to find the pattern that connects. Our cultural bias in industrial society is to always look for the pattern that divides, the pattern that disconnects. And it's destroying us. Because the universe isn't that way. The universe is a whole system, and anything you do to one part of it ricochets out through the rest of it, comes back, and if you're clumsy, it bites you in the backside, as I said.
All right. Have you heard of the term poison container?
Poison container?
Yeah. I think it comes from Lloyd DeMouth, the psychohistorian. It has to do with how, specifically, but not exclusively, parents use children as poison containers. They put their disowned trauma and their hatred and fear and self-rejection, whatever else it is, the stuff that was passed on to them by their parents, they put it into their children.
They dump it into the children and use that to contain their own internal poisons.
Yeah.
That's brilliant.
Yeah.
I had not encountered that idea, but of course, yes, that happens all the time. That's very relevant here, because of course we as a culture do that with everything else, not just with children.
Yeah.
Nature is our poison container. Literally, we're dumping poisons into it, but also we're projecting our own negative traits onto nature.
Yeah. Well, yeah, it occurred to me, I mean, when you were talking, because you were talking about this need for a line and this constant looking to find or define a line separating us, and that could relate to not having boundaries as children and basically swallowing all the shit that was force-fed us, and so constantly trying to create that line, and how that also pertains to, like, for me, the whole environmental crisis. At a certain point, it became, well, wait a minute, isn't this just projection, you know? Isn't the real environmental crisis our own inner pollution, and that we're just constantly disowning all of the negative stuff in order to maintain this illusion about ourselves? And where does that go? It goes into the body, and whether we're alcoholics or drug addicts or sex addicts or any addicts or not, still that the thoughts are things and feelings are chemicals in the body, and so we turn ourselves into poison containers because we've been turned into poison containers, and then of course that does seed the kind of behavior that does turn the whole planet into a poison container. But it also, maybe, who knows how much is actually projection of our own internal state onto the earth and onto the environment to create a massive displacement activity.
Theodore Roszak was saying that back in the early 1970s. If you haven't read Where the Wasteland Ends, that was his major book on that. And he talks about how the environmental crisis is the outward manifestation of our own internal psychological mess. And this is something, of course, that happens in therapy many times. If somebody is refusing to deal with their own problems, those problems will surface in their environment constantly and hammer on them until they finally grapple with just how big of a mess they've made of themselves. You know, this is happening to us as a species, as it happens to many individuals.
Yeah. Yeah, which begs the question, like, what is it to do about it besides see that? Because if we get busy trying to fix it, then we're not...
Mm-hmm.
We think that that's somehow going to bring us peace and well-being if we can fix the environment or other people's beliefs or whatever it is, rather than realizing that we're constantly externalizing the very things that are polluting us and that we're not willing to see.
Well, one of the things that we teach in the Druid organization that I had is that you've got to start with your own life. Now, partly you've got to start with your inner life, but you've also got to start with what you're sending out into the outer world, and that's not just thoughts, it's actions as well.
Yeah.
So in that liminal space between you and the world, how are you affecting the world? And we found very often that once people grasp the fact that they can change the way they live, they don't have to do what the television is telling them to do.
And once they've assumed that responsibility and realized that they have that much say, you mean, in how they live?
That they have the power to do something else.
Yeah.
And it's really remarkable because you'll have people who are just absolutely delighted. They're thrilled. I mean, they've known on an intellectual level, but they've never tried it. They've never actually, you know, looked at their life. We require, in our first degree training program, we require people to make 3 changes in their lifestyle to decrease the burden they place on the biosphere. We don't tell them which 3 changes to make. They have to choose them.
Mm-hmm.
They choose them and have to carry off, keep them going for a year. And some people do very simple things. Some people do very complex things. Some people do vast things, like give up their cars. You know, it depends on what. But even something very simple, once it's done and it really sinks in, you don't have to live the way everybody tells you you have to live. You don't have to take your lifestyle from your society. You can just choose what you're going to do. You can choose what you're sending out. It's something that many people find very surprising and very liberating.
Yeah.
And we found in many, many cases, people will start with 3 little changes, and, you know, 3 years down the road, they're living in a rural farm somewhere.
Right.
It's happened to an astonishing degree. They've completely turned their lives around. And, you know, their spouse start out going, I don't know about this, and the spouse gets into it. And pretty soon the spouse is saying, oh, why don't we do this? Oh, you know, why don't we tear up the grass in the backyard and put in a vegetable garden? I've always wanted to do a vegetable garden, never got around to it. And pretty soon they're eating homegrown vegetables most of the time.
Right.
There is a huge amount of freedom to be gained by embracing liminality. And that's one of the other ways we can talk about what's up with our society is that it's trying to deny the existence of freedom.
Right.
Trying to say, you know, you have, this is what you are, this is what you have to be, this is what you have to do, you have no choice. And there's, you know, you get all these people going around saying human beings don't have free will, they're just, you know, automatons who are condemned to do this, and it's a crock of crap, frankly.
Well, this came up, you probably noticed that was me commenting at your blog, so I thought I probably would bring this up, your objection to determinism, and I think now I understand it. So I guess my view here is that I could simplify it, and also I'd be saying something I said in the past, but I think it at least will help me to express my view that we only begin to have what you call free will. I don't really use the term when we recognize that we don't have it.
Mm-hmm.
I feel that we have a socially conditioned self, which really is just a collection of conditions, conditioning, mm-hmm. and it's automatic behavior. We're reacting, but there is something underneath that, which is mm-hmm. what we were talking about earlier—the pristine psyche and the pure body—and that only can flourish in spontaneity. But I would say, just to round off and see if we can agree here, that the spontaneity can only really happen as a response to the environment. So in that sense, it's not like there's this little self in the head that's saying, I'm going to do this now. It's a living response to the whole system.
It's always in response to the whole system, but it's a spontaneous response.
Yeah.
This is another of those things where people tend to go all the way to one extreme, all the way to the other. Of course, many things about our psyche are determined. Of course, there are limits that we abide by. There isn't a little self sitting in the head with these levers deciding moment by moment what we're going to do. But we have the capacity for spontaneity.
Yeah.
And I think that capacity is, it's always there, and most people show it at least now and then. But it can be developed. It can ripen.
Yeah.
It can be encouraged, or the opposite, depending on how we relate to the various pressures for conformity that are brought to bear on us by the machine, by the society. And so, to say that that the capacity for free will exists is not to say that everybody has it all the time already. It's like one of the things that I used to object to very, very strenuously about some of the people in the New Age movement. Sometimes they would go, you create your own reality. And I say, no, actually you don't.
Mm-hmm.
You can. And the problem, your problems are coming from the fact you haven't yet learned how to do so. that what you're doing is simply taking a reality that's been spoon-fed to you by your culture, by the media, by your teachers, by your parents, what have you, and taking that as real. You can change that. You can, not again, not infinitely. There are things you will not be able to do. I don't care how hard you try. But there are changes you can make in it. And when you learn to do that, and learn both the possibilities and the limits, then things really open up. Then you can start making things happen.
Mm-hmm. Well, the other point I make to those people, if I ever encounter them, is if you can create your reality, then you already are. So all the situations that you want to get out of by learning the secret and the law of attraction, you already created them. So what makes you think it's going to be any better when you start trying to do it?
That's good, yeah. I lived in Oregon. I lived in a little town called Ashland, which is in very far southern Oregon and is inhabited by a lot of people from the San Francisco Bay Area. And there were all of these people there who were very deeply into David Icke.
Yeah.
I don't know if you're familiar, his whole thing about evil space lizards who actually run the world. And they were also very, very heavily into the New Age. And I would ask them, okay, if you create your own reality, right? Yeah. Why are you creating a reality that's ruled by evil space lizards?
Mm-hmm.
And that would usually put an end to the conversation pretty quickly. Because, of course, they were creating a universe run by evil space lizards because that meant they weren't responsible for everything they didn't like about themselves. And so often that's what happens when people get into the hardcore determinist thing is they're saying, I'm not responsible for my own problems. No, you aren't 100% responsible for your own problems. Nobody set out. Very few people. I mean, I'm sure there must be an exception to prove the rule here. But very few people set out to produce a miserable life for themselves.
Mm-hmm.
But the interaction between your choices and the various forces playing on you has generated this thing. And if you make different choices, you can get different results. That's all I'm trying to say with regard to the whole issue of free will.
Mm.
There's some freedom. There's wiggle room in the system. There's liminality in the system. There's the capacity to not just clank and buzz like a robot doing what you've been told.
Well, I think my most enlightening experience of this has been renovating this house, actually, because
mm-hmm.
You were touching on it earlier that it's not enough to have the theory, you need to practice. And so when I bought this house, with my wife, we knew it was a dilapidated crack house. It was, nobody wanted it. In fact, the first estate agent we had didn't even want to show it us. He said, it's horrible, don't even go there. And we believed him. But then we ran out of options and we finally said, well, let's look at the horror house. We called it the Hell House. and we went to see it, and it took days, and we had to bribe the owners to actually let us in, because you can imagine what they were doing in there. And when we finally saw it, it was horrific. It was horrendous. But somehow we both came away, and we looked at each other and we were like, yeah, I could live there. And it was non-rational. It was counterintuitive. And all the rest of it. We just had a feeling, as hideous as it was at the surface, a literal poison container. We felt that it was doable. And as soon as we reached that decision, we also began to see it or recognize, oh, this will be an enactment. This is, you know, the house represents the body. We're going to get it in shape. We're going to clean out all the poisons. We're going to reconstitute it so that we can live there, so the psyche can land back in the body where it belongs. And so it became, okay, it's a narrative. It's a little pattern, all the rest of it, particularly now I've said it a dozen times to different people. But the upshoot of that, of that perspective, of allowing for that, even through some tarot cards, which I very rarely do, and they were very clear about this. Yes, this is going to be really hard, but here, look, this is the outcome. And I recognize, okay, this is my dharma, if you will. This is my challenge. As I was, you know, mid-50s, midlife, and took it on in that spirit. And it, of all the, you know, occult paths and shamanic shenanigans that I've been through and the spiritual retreats, I can tell you, nothing has compared to the experience of just renovating this house and just, you know, hammer, meat, nail.
Doing any act with proper intention is a magical ritual. Yeah. And it sounds to me as though you've tackled a very magical project here, you know, transforming your consciousness and your surroundings using the, you know, the ancient magical tools of hammers, saws. And, you know, it works.
Yeah. Yeah. But it was also, I mean, to me, the essential element was, this wasn't like, what kind of ritual can I do, or what kind of metaphorical enactment? It was the only house I can afford. Yes, we can transform it, you know, belief and trust in our own abilities.
No, it's, yeah, very often the work you need to do is the work that seeks you out. It's not your idea.
Yeah, yeah, I think that's
you know, it's like with me and the Archdruid report. I had no plans of turning it into what it became, but that's the work that was handed to me. So it's been you know, a ritual. It's been an educational experience.
Yes, you seem enormously dedicated, is the sense I get.
Well, partly, I don't know if it's that. It's partly it's fun. Yeah. I love to write. There are writers I know who suffer through the process of putting prose together. I don't. I enjoy it.
Yeah.
And this is a great excuse for me, you know, to sit down once a week at the keyboard and just cut loose and talk about things that you can't talk about in polite society in modern America these days. And I have grand time. And the conversations that get going, even, you know, some people disagree with me, some people, you know, challenge me in various ways, other people bring in ideas and perspectives I'd never thought of before. It really has become as much a school for me as anything else, and a chance to really interact with people, help shape their ideas, learn from them. Again, nothing that I planned, but, oh my, it's been a trip.
Mm-hmm. So bringing it back to where we started with the, what was the phrase again?
Collapse now and avoid the rush.
And avoid the rush, yeah.
And avoid the rush. Well, I mean,
how much
doing,
have
doing...
you collapsed, would you say?
Well, let's see. we have the backyard garden. We use about a fifth as much electricity as most people, or much, you know, energy as people. I don't own a car. We don't own a television. Most of our appliances are the kind of things you'd have found in the 1950s. And there's more. There's further we can go. We moved to a little town in the middle of nowhere. Well, I'm sure my local friends would be offended by that, but we live in a small town in the north central Appalachians.
Yeah.
And we get a lot of local, you know, what we don't grow ourselves, we get a lot of stuff, local meat, local vegetables, things like that are relatively easy to come by. Will I have to downshift further as industrial society flies? Very, you bet.
Mm-hmm.
But we've done our share of collapsing. And here's the secret thing. It's been fun.
Yeah.
We've enjoyed ourselves. We eat better than people who buy stuff at who pick up stuff at a deli. Just flat out, we eat better, and we don't waste our time.
Yeah.
Things have worked very well, and each step we've taken in the direction of further collapse has been an improvement in our lives. It's not a matter of, oh, I'm going to sacrifice this thing that I love, you know.
Right.
The last television I ever owned, I dropped out of a second story, off a second story fire escape into an open dumpster.
Uh-huh.
The flash and bang as the picture tube imploded were more entertaining than anything that had ever been on that screen. That was quite some years ago. That was in 1984.
Well, I hate to tell you this, John Michael, but TV's got a whole lot better since then. So.
Oh, sure, it has. And everyone I know has said that, quite the contrary. Television can do what it wants to. I'm a little bit of a zealot where that's concerned, because, television bored me at best when I was young. And at this point, everything that I've accomplished, I've been able to accomplish because I have all the additional free time that I wouldn't have if I was spending 4 hours a night staring at a tube.
What do you do to relax?
Television doesn't relax you. Have you ever noticed when you watch for a really long time, you get up after like 4 hours, you know how the kind of leaden, draggy feeling you've got?
Well, I'm quite disciplined because I'm an reformed movie addict. I even wrote a book about
gotcha.
It. But TV has got so good now that I've pretty much stopped watching movies and just watch select shows. And I do find it is relaxing, but of course I'm aware of what you're talking about, and I do see it as like junk food, even if it's art. I even see good art potentially as kind of, I'm putting stuff in the psyche that maybe mm-hmm. doesn't belong there.
Oh, always possible.
Yeah.
Okay. Just, I don't find it relaxing. If I want to relax, I can sit back on the couch, I can read, I can play, play music, play a musical instrument. There's all kinds of ways to relax.
Yeah.
Don't involve having some corporation pumping images into your mind.
Sure.
And I don't find TV relaxing at all. So, the people relaxed just fine for tens of thousands of years before the television existed, and I see no reason not to follow their lead.
You okay?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, just a little gunk in the throat.
ask you about 2015, because I know that you are making some predictions about it.
My predictions are always hedged around with a recognition of the uncertainty of things.
Yeah.
We have no way of knowing exactly when the bottom is going to fall out of various bubbles. We do know that it will fall out sooner or later. Okay, the whole fracking thing that we have heard so much about, America's energy independent, blah, 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 crock of crap. It's collapsing as we speak. Companies are going bankrupt. That really hasn't hit the markets yet, but it's going to probably in the second half of this year. We have the collapse of the Chinese stock market. They seem to have propped that up temporarily. There's a world of hurt waiting there. Generally speaking, the global economy is a massive smoke and mirrors. Ever since 2008, there's been this sort of manufactured faux recovery in place that somehow is employing fewer and fewer people. And more and more people are, the standards of living in the United States have been dropping like a stone since the 1970s. And it's getting really bad at this point. But there's this whole smoke and mirrors financial economy. And the question is purely when that's going to implode.
Yeah.
When it does, we're going to see probably another crisis like the one 2008-2009. It could be worse. It could be around the same. I don't think it'll be a lot better. I am expecting that to happen in the fall of this year. I could be wrong. Timing the market is one of those all-time losing bets. You assume that the market will be irrational and will pay no attention to your predictions. But my working guess is that the second half of this year, we're going to see here in the U.S. to a lesser extent, to elsewhere in North America, elsewhere in the world, we're going to see the beginnings of a whopping economic crisis. That's happening at a time when the U.S. Internationally is flailing, when, generally speaking, the U.S. is in a great deal of trouble. And a lot of people are you watch the powers that plan on replacing it sort of positioning themselves and expanding their reach and figuring out, okay, how are we going to deal with the long decline of the decline and fall of American global hegemony? It's going to be a rough ride. I would expect to see, again, in the second half of this year, various financial market problems, possibly some really big name bankruptcies, very likely some really big name bankruptcies. The next few waves of mass layoffs, a lot of just very sharp economic tightening. I don't think we'll get a major banking crisis in the sense of something that will shut banks here in the United States yet, although it's possible. But basically, we're looking at a classic mess like the Great Depression or something like that. We've put it off for a very long time without changing any of the things that are driving it. And sooner or later, quite possibly this fall, we're going to get the first wave of that. And it's going to be a mess.
Are you concerned about... I don't want to get too doomy or too paranoid, but you can always just ignore the question, but are you concerned about a sort of militaristic America becoming a militaristic state?
America is a militaristic
state. Well, that's true. I realize as I said it, but I mean,
okay.
That's the crisis that accelerates.
My real concern here in this country is that the United States could break open into domestic insurgency or even civil war.
Yeah.
The level of internal hatred in this country is like nothing since 1860.
Right.
And we know what followed after that was Fort Sumter and the Civil War. The level of rage being directed by people of different political parties against each other, the degree to which the U.S. government seems to be gearing for an insurgency, militarizing police departments, doing vast amounts of domestic training of American troops, I think they expect an insurgency, and I think they're probably going to get it. Among other things, the U.S. has been manufacturing insurgencies around the world.
Yeah.
You know, the business in Ukraine, the business in Syria, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. We love to try to start guerrilla wars against, or urban risings against governments we don't like. And you've got to know that the Russians, the Chinese, various other people have been looking at that and saying, okay, suck it, who can play this game? And so it would not surprise me. I mean, I don't have proof of this, of course. This is pure speculation, but it would not surprise me for a moment if some of those beady-eyed men in the Kremlin, some equally beady-eyed old men in Beijing, possibly, the U.S. has a lot of enemies, have been quietly funding anti-government propaganda here in the United States.
It could even be the American government. Couldn't it create an insurgence for its own ends?
It might be, but the problem is that something like that could spin out of control so easily in this country.
Hmm.
The level of I don't. The U.S. government could, but I think they would try to make something fake. And I think what I'm seeing now looks far too real.
Right.
And it would be. I don't think when people are flinging around the partisan hatreds right now, I don't think anybody has stopped to think about what would happen if the U.S. were to go into, a full-scale Iraq-style domestic insurgency where you can't drive down the highway without risking having your car blown up with an IED, where, different ethnic and political and religious factions are having, shooting battles with each other. The economy has collapsed. Millions of people fleeing to other countries, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. We could have that here.
Yeah.
We could have that here in a matter of a few years if the right people are stupid enough. And that's a hideous thing. That's not something that's going to benefit anybody, except, again, those beady-eyed guys in Beijing and Moscow, who will be able to sit back and say, "Okay, America, deal with your business now. Oh, and you won't have any troops to spare for the rest of the world until that's settled, will you?"
Right.
Mm-hmm. So we'll see. But that's been my concern for some time now. That the most likely future of America is not some kind of increase of its current militaristic attitude, but actually a descent into civil war.
Hmm.
We could get a fascist takeover. One thing there is the fascist takeover won't be the current government. Again, the current government presumably has what it wants. Fascist groups always come from the, they come from outside the status quo. Most people don't remember that.
Right.
They don't remember that, Mussolini, Hitler, these people were on the fringe. And even though they got some support from the big corporations and so on, the corporations paid. And so, it was not the sort of straightforward Marxist fantasy that the big capitalist manufactured fascism. It's much more complex than that. I could see somebody, I could see some politician saying, it is time that the U.S., that we take back this country from big business, from the banking industry and this kind of stuff, and, having his armbands of stormtroopers in weeks, taking over the country. Oh, and by the way, we've scrapped the Constitution, and you no longer have civil rights, but that's what we need to do to fight the special interests, Piece of cake.
Are you familiar with Amy Hale, who wrote about the pagan right? Radical traditionalism.
Oh, yeah. Okay, gotcha. I've encountered tradition. I mean, it's kind of hard to miss traditionalism if you're in the occult scene, but I haven't primarily got it from Amy Hale. I primarily heard from traditionalists.
Right. There seems to be a growing movement, for lack of a mm-hmm. better word, because it's always hard to identify when we're talking about ideas and philosophies, but within the, I call it the alternate perceptions community, because it's not really a New Age community, and it's definitely not restricted to occultism or ufology. It's sort of a merging of these different audience cults. And I guess you're on the fringe of it, as I am. I don't really partake of it, but I do know people in it and even have them on this podcast. Anyway, there's been a growing movement that specifically can be identified, specifically there's a thing called Red Ice Radio, but it's certainly not restricted to that, of more and more extremist, rightist politics kind of emerging like a sprout from the not just occult, but these alternate perception philosophies. And you're talking about Ike with the lizards. Well, more and more people believing, whether they believe in space lizards or not, but that the world is run by psychopathic, shamanic, reality manipulating social engineers. I mean, I kind of believe that myself. But they take it not just that they take it literally, they take it personally, and they also approach it, as we were talking about earlier, as something that has to be fixed. And so then there's this growing movement, it would seem, of we need to take out these psychopaths, we need to actually get society back on track. And it carries all of this kind of expected ingredients of, I call it Thulianism, but you know, that Hitler was the world avatar, and that Zion, you know, the Jews, watch out for the Jews, and various different elements that are immediately identifiable as what characterized Nazism, and not just Nazism. That's just obviously the biggest, baddest example of it.
But yeah, and I don't see a great deal of that, but that's primarily because people know I don't. I have no tolerance for it. Generally, the Druid community doesn't get much of that, although there are some offshoots here and there that do engage in that kind of thing. But yeah, I know it's out there. At the moment, I'm not sure how serious of a threat it is, but of course, the Thule Society, the Thule Gesellschaft, was a very small organization back in 1919 and 1920.
Yeah.
You know, until they launched that little party of theirs, the German Workers Party, which got this Austrian war vet, and then we saw what happened.
Mm.
Could something of the same sort happen? Of course. Could something more like Mussolini, you know, just see some, a more middle-of-the-road outfit? Yes. Could there be? It's really hard to tell when you have this unstable of a situation, when the political system and the institutions of the society have basically lost their legitimacy in the eyes of most of the public. And most people think of the people who run the political world as a bunch of crooks.
Yeah.
Not inappropriately, to be frank.
Yeah.
Most people are looking at the institution and say, this is set up to rip me off. You never know what's going to come boiling out. And it depends very much on personalities. It depends very much, you know, if somebody who's involved in this whole, what you call Neo-Thulianism, happens to be charismatic and is a good speaker, it could go all over the place. If they don't happen to pull that card in the lottery of membership, well, you know, something else. I'm actually expecting to see a large-scale revival of Marxism in the United States in the next few years. The Republican Party has put so much effort into calling, you know, and like, sick pay is a communist plot, that I honestly think they're going to drive a whole generation of people to decide to give Marx a second chance.
Mm-hmm.
But there again, if they happen to get some charismatic leaders, they could go places. If they don't, it'll just be a fringe thing. You just never know.
Would it make a difference, do you think? I mean, would that be preferable, a Marxist movement?
Well, given how badly Marxism worked the first time around, no.
All
right. Really, I don't. The thing is, a lot depends on what you mean by preferable, because you know that's a value judgment. It depends on what you prefer.
Yeah.
Nothing is going to stop the end of industrial society. Yeah. Nothing is going to stop the decline of standards of living to third world levels all across the industrial world. Nothing is going to stop a fairly rough decrease in population over the next 1 to 3 centuries. It's going to be a rough time, no matter what we do. Can it be made worse? You bet. Could it be made better? Maybe. if you read accounts of the decline and fall of other civilizations, which is what we're talking about here, you know, there are situations where things can be made better, can be made worse, but the trajectory is the same in either case. So there is very much a matter of first we work on ourselves, and then we see what we do, you know, from that perspective. Okay, what can we do to the wider world? What can we do to save something? As all of this seems to, as everything seems to be coming so busily and enthusiastically unglued.
Mm.
So.
Yeah.
I can say that for a bummer.
Well, I don't personally see it as a bummer. I don't think you do either. So I mean, of course, that's what comes to cause the convulsion could be really, will be very painful for whoever's alive to go through it. But I mean, this does seem to be the downside of denying liminality or not embracing liminality, is that that you create a society that keeps liminality at bay, but that actually can't sustain itself and so leads to periods of extreme liminality, of chaos.
It's as though if you build a dam against liminality, the total supply builds up until the dam breaks and washes everything else away.
Yeah, and that would seem to be the upside. I mean, I think this is inseparable from Kunstler's re-enchantment of the world, is that if we're suppressing our unconscious at any cost just to remain in that tiny bandwidth of conscious illusory control, then the price of losing that control is everything, but what we gain is another everything that is worth vastly more, which is the life of the body and the organism and the re-experiencing of the whole system, the collective system, and our part in it.
There's a line from T.S. Eliot that I'm trying to remember, and I unfortunately don't have my copy of Four Quartets handy, but it's something on the order of an experience of complete simplicity costing nothing less than everything. And, you know, that's the only way out in a time like this. Is that, you know, the capacity to let go of everything.
Yeah.
And trust yourself to the flow. Trust yourself to the floodwaters of liminality, if you like. And that's part of the whole, collapse now and avoid the rush. It's jump into the waters of liminality.
That was how I understood it.
Let them take you where they're going to take you.
Yeah. Because the day is coming for everyone anyway, where we have to let go of everything. So it's...
Oh, yeah.
Not that great a leap of imagination, really. Just seems like it. Well, we've almost been on 2 hours. I feel it's been very fruitful, and I've been at a loss for words several times, but I've allowed that because I think it's better than just okay. trying to be clever. But I've really enjoyed talking to you.
Thank you. I've enjoyed our conversation also.
I have one little thing I want to bring up because it might be my only chance. And that was in the UFO book, you referred to satanic ritual abuse as hysteria, as being down to mass hysteria.
No, that's a complicated situation. There are a few cases of ritual abuse that actually happened. But in a vast number of cases in the United States, certainly, it was in fact a manufactured mass hysteria. It came out when I don't know if you heard about the whole situation in Wenatchee, where dozens and dozens of people. It resembled nothing so much as the Salem witch trials. And once people started suing for damages, the whole thing came unraveled, and it turned out, you know, who was making up the accusations, who was flinging around these things, and what they were getting out of it.
Yeah.
So it had, you know, one can't say in so many words that nasty things happen, especially in isolated little subcultures and groups. But in terms of the big American satanic ritual abuse panic, I'm going to stand by that one. Everything that I've seen suggests that there was a huge amount of, on the one hand, mass hysteria. On the other hand, a lot of hardcore fundamentalist Christians who were using that as a way to beat up on the Wiccan and occult scene.
I think it did get picked up in that way. I don't know as much about the U.S., but what's happening in Britain now, which may be of interest to you.
I'm familiar with the organized rings of sexual abuse of young girls there.
It's incredible how much is coming to light, and although the satanic ritual aspect hasn't come so much out yet, I anticipate that it will. And the ties to many different groups, including Freemasons, and so the ritual aspects are there. So just my sense is that it's, although people do panic and it does get distorted as a result of the panic, and the Christians have a great capacity to distort everything, as you probably would agree, although despite all that, my sense more and more is that what's actually really happening is perhaps even more endemic and far-reaching than the wildest panicked fantasies of Christians. Mm. That's my feeling. I just thought I'd mention it because you're on the record there. But it was something I felt a bit tense around, because I've been looking into my family background, and there does seem to be stuff there. It just seems to be part of the whole this period that we're entering into, which is the collapse of the institutions, or at least the collapse of trust in the institutions. Mm-hmm. In Britain now, it's reaching a critical point, really, because there's just no way to really trust in the institutions or the leaders without just actually pretending that none of it's happening, which I think does create this incredible psychic tension.
And that, again, is the kind of thing that leads to social explosions, to revolutions, to insurgencies, to drastic political transformations.
Yeah, actually, my guess for a revolution would... I was talking about it with my wife, because her opinion is that the American government, or the powers that be, anyway, have been trying to create an insurgence in the US, but they underestimated how effective the sort of dumbing down, brainwashing, and dopifying of the collective has been, and they can't rouse them. Try as they might. I counted that it seems more likely in Britain, actually, and I think if there was a revolution in Britain, that might have a ripple down to the U.S.
But I would also, you know, whatever the U.S. government may have in mind in the U.S., I would not discount the possibility that other powers have a finger in that pie as well, because it would be such an... It's one of those obvious gimme moves, and it'd be so easy. The thing is, dumbing down is not necessarily preventive against violence.
No, that's true.
People have been very slow to engage in violence, and we have domestic terrorists from on the far right that nobody wants to talk about here. We don't have a lot of it, but we do have a steady drumbeat of that. But, you know, as in France before the French Revolution, there was all these years where, you know, people were saying, well, why don't the French peasants rise up? Why doesn't this happen? You know, it happens when it happens. There's a Mexican proverb, nothing happens until it happens. And I hope it doesn't. Because, again, civil war, domestic insurgency, revolution, it's going to destroy far more than it creates, even in the best case scenario. But there are peaceful, legal ways to do the thing. But I think we've probably passed the point where that's a possibility now, so I'm very much afraid we're going to get it.
Mm.
So we'll see.
Yeah, we'll live to see. With any luck, my goals are scaling down consistently and becoming humbler and humbler, and just kind of focusing on community life here, which I've never really participated in before. That's the idea with the radio station, is to actually do something that might enhance the community in some way. But of course, make a living doing it. That's the first agenda always, but. So we'll see how that goes.
Okay.
Great. Well, I guess we've reached our natural end.
Monkey said to man, I want your fireman. Said to monkey, I want your brain. Monkey said to man, my desire is to be like the mankind. And this was all the monkey said when this world come tumbling.
Monkey said to man, I want your fireman. Said to monkey, I want your prayer. Monkey said to man, my desire is to be like the mankind. And this was all the monkey spoke when his word came tumbling down. Here comes the monkey, and monkey speaks his mind. Oh, here comes the monkey. Oh, here comes the monkey, and monkey speaks his mind. And this was all that monkey spoke when his word came tumbling down.
La vie dans la jungle, c'est quand même bien sympa. Sur les arbres prêts.